Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. The things we do to upset our brains, whether it's drinking coffee or zonking out on cocaine, the chemicals can actually change cell structure in the brain. Psychologist Dr. Brian Kolb from the University of Lethbridge has made some startling discoveries which may lead to different treatments for male and female addicts. And his colleague, Dr. Robin Gibb, has looked at how rats that exercise during pregnancy produce babies that are smarter and recover from brain injury much better. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. The University of Lethbridge is home to the Canadian Centre for Behavioural Neuroscience. And one of the star researchers there is Dr. Brian Kolb, a professor of psychology and holder of the Board of Governors Research Chair in Neuroscience. Brian was in Edmonton recently to give a public lecture at the Odysseum. Among the many discoveries that Brian has made is how cells in the frontal lobe regions of the brain change differentially according to gender. This could ultimately lead to different addiction treatments for male and female addicts.
I suppose I'm a frontal lobe chauvinist and started studying it in 1971 for my PhD work. And over the years, I've continued to perseverate on looking at it and comparing it in a variety of species and whatnot. Most recently, we've made some discoveries that are quite puzzling and I think probably fundamentally important in the long run, although right now they're still puzzles. And so if you think about frontal lobe organization, the frontal lobe is the seat of certain kinds of intelligence. Certainly, people with frontal lobe injuries can't plan. Their behavior is generally disorganized. They have short-term memory problems. They have difficulty forming social relationships and so on. So it's an important structure. Its size is very large in people and probably reflects the fact that our social structure is so complicated. You need to look no further than 14-year-old girls to see how complicated it can be. Our mental life is very complicated. And so the various regions of the frontal lobe have very similar architecture, cellular architecture, very similar connections, but clearly have somewhat different functions. And so the assumption that I made was that, being a frontal lobe chauvinist, that anything that was really important that happened to you would be reflected in changes in the structure of the frontal lobe. And I also thought that what was good for the goose was good for the gander, and that is if one region changes in response to, say, a drug, the other regions will change as well, or maybe not as much, but they'll change in the same way. And the first discovery we made was some time ago, and that was that when we look at exposure to gonadal hormones, estrogen or testosterone, we found that different regions of the frontal lobe responded differently. So, for example, if you think of the stuff that's on the top of your head at the front, so I'll call that dorsolateral frontal cortex, the cells in that region are larger in males than in females. And if you look at the cells that are behind your eye, in the so-called orbital frontal cortex, reflecting the orbit of your socket of the eye, those cells are bigger in females than males. And if we look at the size of the various regions in humans, we find that those regions are bigger as well as having bigger cells, but it's in an opposite way. That is, the dorsolateral cortex is bigger in females than in males, but the cells within there are bigger in males than in females.
What do you think accounts for that gender difference?
I think it's related to the distribution of receptors for the hormones. So receptors are essentially little locks, and the hormone acts as a key. And so we see different distributions in males and females of these receptors, and that presumably reflects the fact that the hormones affect the two regions differently. So we knew that there were these effects related to sex hormones. But when we started studying psychomotor stimulants and opiates and so on, one of the discoveries we made was that if you take nicotine, for example, and you take the equivalent of one cigarette a day for a period of a month or less, probably 3 weeks, we can see what appear to be, if you're a rat, permanent changes in the structure of cells. And what we found was that cells in the dorsolateral region got bigger. So we increased the number of synapses by about, which are connections, by about 20%, and that doesn't go away.
Why did they get bigger?
The inputs this is key to what I'm going to say, the input from the brainstem, there's a input from cells that make dopamine, and they release dopamine. Dopamine is related to reward, and any drug that's psychoactive, that you experience some sort of cognitive change, usually has a release of dopamine. So it was something to do with the dopamine release that's critical to making these cells get bigger and forming new connections. We assumed that, or I assumed, I won't blame anybody else, that the same kind of things would happen in other places in the frontal lobe. So I had to give a talk in Toronto related to orbital frontal activity and function, and I was just going to assume it was the same as the dorsolateral frontal lobe. But I thought, you really should just look at one brain and confirm this is true before you go spouting off. And when I looked at the brain, I went, oh, crap. It's obviously the reverse. And so what we saw was that the cells were smaller there, and they had lost about 20% of their connections. So now we have this imbalance, if you like, in the cells in the two regions. Well, we looked at nicotine, amphetamine, cocaine, marijuana, all of them did that. And so that really was an alarm bell saying there's something fundamental here that's important. We then looked at morphine and discovered something completely unexpected, and that is it was the opposite. That is, the cells in the dorsolateral cortex got smaller and the cells in the orbital cortex got bigger. So those drugs are acting on the brain in fundamentally different ways.
What does that mean then?
The curious thing is that the both regions are getting this dopamine input. The same input that's being activated by the drug is producing diametrically opposed changes. So it's clear that if you're thinking about curing addiction or curing problems related to drugs, what you have to do is return these two regions to the balance that you started with. But remember, there's a sex difference. So it's on top of the sex difference that we're looking at. And so now we're beginning to realize that maybe the treatments for men and women might not be the same treatments. They could be different treatments. As we kept probing this and looking at other things that might affect the brain, we discovered that we consistently find this asymmetry in the changes in the brain. In parallel to this, other people had been looking at depressive people and had shown early on that the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex showed a decrease in activity in depressed people. And it was later discovered by a fellow called Drevets and his colleagues that the orbital cortex shows an increase in activity in depressives. So it's not just that everything is reduced. We have regional differences that are strikingly similar to what we were finding with the drugs. If drugs are effective as antidepressants, they return the balance. If they're not effective, all they do is reduce the activity in the orbital cortex, and the dorsolateral cortex doesn't change. The opposite doesn't seem to happen. So it's clear that our understanding of different disorders may hinge on understanding why these brain regions are changing differentially. Schizophrenia is associated with cells that are simpler in the dorsolateral cortex, and they seem to be more complicated in the orbital cortex. So we're beginning to get a feel, and of course that's where people initially did lobotomies thinking they could cure schizophrenia. Didn't work at all. But the asymmetry here is important. The two regions don't develop at the same rate. The orbital cortex develops sooner than the dorsolateral cortex. There are sex differences in the developmental rate. And so we're beginning to realize that there are all kinds of things going on here that must be key to understanding brain function. We've recently looked at different strains of rats that were bred for proneness to seizures. So animals that are seizure-prone versus animals that are resistant to seizures, and we found that these two regions and no other places we've looked were differentially affected by the breeding. So the animals that are seizure prone have bigger cells in the dorsolateral cortex. The animals that are seizure resistant have bigger cells in the orbital cortex. I have no idea why. That's what we found.
Well, if you take all of this, what does it mean for a person? And if you're dealing with some sorts of addictions or disorders, can you change the brain either to go back to be normal, or are you dealing with something that comes from birth and you have to totally change the brain in order to give the person some sort of normal functioning?
Boy, that's a tough one. The goal would be to reverse the cells back. We'll make the assumption, which may not be true, that to get rid of the addiction, we need to get rid of this asymmetry in the structure and get it back to whatever was there. But you've touched on something else, in that there are clearly individual differences in susceptibility to drugs and addiction to drugs. And it's our hunch, and we're currently looking at this, that animals that are more likely to be addicted are going to have bigger changes than animals that are less likely to be addicted, and the preliminary evidence is that that's so. So there is some sort of genetic difference that presumably is there from the beginning, but you can't predict that just looking at the cells. It's the response to the drug, and then we look at the cells and see that the cells are differentially responding to these drugs, but the question is why? Why is that occurring? We have the faintest idea.
Do you have any indication at this time that the prenatal experience, say the mother was drinking or doing drugs, if that's going to have an effect on what the child's brain is like and how they respond later on?
We're pretty certain that it will. It turns out in North America, roughly 10% of women drink during pregnancies, and 25% smoke, and probably 100% take caffeine, either as cola or as chocolate or tea or coffee and so on, right? And we know that caffeine also changes the brain, but in a different way. Not a finding I wanted to make as a caffeine addict. So we are pretty sure that the experiences that you have prenatally, we know that they're going to alter the way the brain develops. And we know that there's an interaction between exposure to drugs or exposure to stress and later brain plasticity. I'll give you a concrete example in postnatal animals, but we're sure it's true prenatal. We're doing the experiments now. If you give animals exposure to a drug such as nicotine, and then you later put them in an environment that ought to produce massive changes in the brain, a complicated environment, it's blocked. It just doesn't happen. So we see no change in response to the drug. It's not because the brain can't change, because if we give more drug, the brain changes. So now let's give babies nicotine prenatally. 20 to 25% of kids are being exposed to nicotine prenatally. I was too. And we now look at how they're going to respond to experiences later. It's going to be different than if they were not exposed to the nicotine prenatally. The question is, can we somehow get around this phenomenon? I think I turned out more or less okay. So it looks like it's not terminal. There are ways around it. But nonetheless, in our animal studies, it looks like we can produce profound effects from this prenatal exposure.
We always tend to blame the mom, but what part does the father play in this prenatal experience?
Well, Robin Gibb, who is a colleague of mine, a former student of mine, is looking now at the effect of alcohol on the dad. And it turns out that alcohol can alter the expression of various genes. The DNA can actually be altered. And it turns out that it's the dad's DNA that's probably more critical in producing abnormalities in the offspring. So here we've thought all along it was just the mama couldn't drink, and it's probably the dad who shouldn't be doing various things. Of course, once the mom's pregnant, it makes no difference, but it's the development of his sperm that's critical and is affected by some of these drugs. It's a surprising way of looking at it, and we're working with a colleague in Lethbridge, Olga Kovalchuk, who's a molecular geneticist, and so she's helping us do the molecular studies to try and get at this.
Where are you going to take this work now? What's next for you?
There's a variety of ways we can go with this. One is to try and understand developmental disorders such as ADHD, autism, and whatnot, and try and apply this to models of that. The other thing is, once we know that there are ways of changing the brain, both in adults and during development, we can now use this to our advantage to change the brain when we want to. So if you have an injury either perinatally or in a child or in an adult, knowing that there are things that alter the brain in a consistent way, we can actually attempt to use that to our advantage and change the brain post-injury. So that's another direction we're headed.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Brian Kolb, a professor of psychology at the University of Lethbridge and holder of the Board of Governors Research Chair in Neuroscience. He's a founding researcher with the Canadian Center for Behavioral Neuroscience, and he is a recipient of an Aztec Award for Research Excellence. Another rising star at the Canadian Centre for Behavioural Neuroscience at the University of Lethbridge is Dr. Robin Gibb. Robin is the first PhD graduate from the centre, and she's now an assistant professor at the university. Much of Robin's research has focused on prenatal experience and what that means for the development of the offspring's brains.
I'm interested in how experiences that a pregnant mother may have can affect the way her baby develops brain-wise. And so I have been looking at things like complex housing with rats and looking at pregnant rats and finding that animals that are in this type of housing through the duration of their pregnancy have babies that show a tremendous ability to solve problems like water maze, spatial cognition tasks and things along those lines, and as well as showing motor improvements as they age. And in the case of animals that receive early brain injury, this prenatal experience really makes a difference in the way that they recover, to a point that animals that have had moms that were raised in complex housing have performance on the various tasks that we put them through, this behavioral repertoire that we test them on, that mimics a completely normal rat, as a matter of fact. So it's a profound effect it has.
Well, I have to ask you, from a rat's perspective, what is complex housing?
Complex housing is we put our rats in an enclosure that's about 6 feet tall, and it has various ramps and swings, and it has wire mesh for the animals to climb on. So they have ability to have a lot of exercise. They can also interact with their environment. And there is a social component to this as well, because there's 6 females in the enclosure at the same time, as well as a male rat.
So that beats the cage.
It beats the cage to a huge degree. Mothers that are housed in this type of housing, as a matter of fact, when we have to put them back in their normal shoebox housing when the babies are born, they find that a bit traumatic. So we get them used to the idea of going back to their home cage by putting them away in a shoebox cage every night. So they're in the condominiums during the light hours of the day, and in the dark hours of the day, they are in a normal shoebox house. So they have two homes, so to speak, and they spend the day playing, and at night they're in the regular environment.
So while they're in this complex housing environment, they're pregnant. And what is the significance of that?
It's rather hard to put our finger on it exactly, but we do know that with complex housing, there's a variety of different things that happen in the brains of animals that experience this type of housing, and that includes changes in the expression of a variety of proteins that are known to enhance brain repair and brain plasticity. And it seems as though the experience that the mother has is some way changing the way that the brain of the pups in utero are developing. So we're not clear on whether it's the proteins that the mother's producing, or it's the mother's activity that's giving the brain's extra stimulation of these babies, or just what it is that's allowing this beautiful recovery or behavioral advantage to the animals that are born to moms that are reared, that are housed in this type of an environment while they're pregnant.
Well, what happens then? The baby's born, and then how do you test for the difference?
Okay, well, what happens is when the babies are born, the moms return to the shoebox housing situation, and that's where they stay. So the babies have no personal experience in the complex housing whatsoever. They're allowed to grow up, and at the age of about 60 days of age, where they're starting to be mature enough to test on a variety of tasks, then we start looking at tests that test their cognitive ability and tests that test their motor abilities. And that's when we start to notice that there's great improvements in animals that have had early brain injury, as well as improvements in animals that have not sustained brain injury, so that they actually perform better than control babies that are born to mothers in the shoebox cages.
Well, is that something you can extrapolate to the human situation?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, most of the animal research we do here is aimed at eventually helping the human condition. And so it does seem to me that there are some basic points that one could make about the idea of exercise and stimulation during pregnancy and how important that might be. There have been a few case studies of mothers, human mothers, and how their activity levels may correlate with the performance of their babies as they grow up. And there is some evidence, although it has not been proven again, or shown again in other people's research, but there has been some evidence that mothers who exercise have babies who have do somewhat better at academics when they enter school.
And that has to do with the excretion of these proteins?
It could be the proteins. It could be a slight stressor that the mothers experience when you exercise. You have a slight increase in some of your stress hormones. We're not exactly sure what it's related to, but we do know that it seems to be a very positive thing. So it looks like if you're a mom who likes to sit and watch TV, that maybe it wouldn't hurt to get off the couch and go for a walk. But it's hard to say at this phase because it's so early going. But we are looking at a variety of different tests to try to determine what's changing in the brains of these animals. And this involves looking at DNA, a gene expression, and a variety of other things to see if we're altering gene expression, changing the kinds of proteins that the brain is making in these animals that have early experience, and then influencing the way the brain further develops after this change in gene expression.
Now, the focus of that research was on the moms, but you've also been doing some work on the babies and the stimulation of the baby rats. What's that about?
Well, I have looked into tactile stimulation and how that can improve an animal's recovery or potential recovery after early brain injury. Now, these are injuries that involve the frontal cortex, and one of the things that Brian Kolb, who I've worked with in the past many years, has found is that if you give a rat a frontal cortex lesion on during the first week of life, they suffer a form of brain injury that will impair them to a great extent on these tests that I've just mentioned when they grow up into adulthood. But if you give an animal that very same injury the second week of life, around day 10, they have this beautiful spontaneous recovery, and the brain actually regrows itself to some extent, and they're almost as good as controls on the tests that I've just mentioned. So we knew that the brain has this potential for self-repair, and we wondered if there was some way we could stimulate it in the case of the young animals to get the repair process happening. We knew that there has been work published on premature infants that show that tactile stimulation of premature babies helps them to gain weight, and they mature a little better, and they're usually released from hospital somewhat sooner than babies that don't receive that type of treatment. So we thought we'd try tactile stimulation with these infant rats post-lesion to see if that also improved their behavioral recovery when they grew up.
What would you do? How would you stimulate them?
Well, we used a brush that sort of like a blush brush for makeup, and it's a very soft camel hair type of brush, and they were taken away from their moms for 15 minutes three times a day and given the stimulation just during the pre-weaning period, so up until about 21 days of age. Then they were placed in normal cages, allowed to grow up so they could be tested, and once they were tested, we found that they had this lovely behavioral recovery that seemed to be mediated by the tactile stimulation.
What accounts for that?
Well, I was curious about that, too. So I started looking at the skin. The skin and brain happened to be formed at the same time. And I was wondering if there was anything that was changing in the skin from the tactile stimulation that might help account for why the brain showed this lovely recovery. And it turns out that in the animals that received the tactile stimulation, they produced proteins that are involved in skin repair, but are also involved in repairing the brain. And this protein production was upregulated in the animals that received the tactile stimulation. And it seemed to also be upregulated in the brains of these animals. And so my guess was then that these proteins that the skin was producing was helping to repair the brain.
So you're doing this tactile stimulation on the baby rats, and it shows improvement. What does that mean for human babies?
Well, it is true that it's difficult to say because this hasn't really been tested in any way as far as babies with brain injury goes, but just as an anecdotal bit of evidence, there was a woman that worked in Brian Kolb's lab a few years ago who had a baby born to her that was mentally challenged, and the baby, when the doctor saw her, said that there was really nothing that this woman could do as far as improving her performance or her intelligence, and she was unwilling to take that as her final answer, so she kept seeing people, and one doctor finally suggested that she might try some forms of tactile stimulation with the child to see if that would help get her to do things or help her progress beyond the point that the other doctors had believed that she would only get to. And this woman tried the technique. She was diligent about it. She did it several times a day with terry towel, toweling, and various types of different kinds of tactile stimulation. And her child was able to progress to a level of about a 12 or 13-year-old when the doctors told her that she'd never be out of diapers and she would always be sort of at a 2 or 3 year old levels. So it's a one case only situation. You never know what might have happened without the stimulation, but that's the beauty of animal research, is we can control the experience the animals have. We can control the site of the lesion. We can control all of the variables involved in these types of situations and come up with an understanding of whether or not these types of treatments actually do make a difference. And in the case of tactile stimulation, I'm going to go on record as saying it looks like it does make a difference.
What's next for you?
Well, I'm also intrigued at the role of the father in this whole experience. And so I've devised an experiment in conjunction with Olva Kolbachuk here at the university, and she's a geneticist. And I asked her if she thought it was feasible that the father impact could make a huge difference in the way of the brain is developing. And she said, actually, in genetics, people look at father first, not mother first. She felt that the father being housed in complex housing during a period where spermatogenesis was taking place might have an even bigger impact on gene expression and eventual brain development in babies. So that's one of the experiments that's coming up.
So if people are planning on having a baby, then both of them better get out there and do some exercise. Is that what you're saying?
It looks like mother while pregnant, it's a good idea to be careful what you're eating and get the proper amount of exercise and rest. And dads ahead of time, ahead of conception, at least 6 weeks ahead of the time that you might think that it's time to have a baby, it's probably a good idea to abstain from alcohol, take care of yourself, make sure you're getting proper rest and exercise and doing stimulating things. That's what we're going to find out anyway, to see if it makes a difference.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Oh, you're welcome.
That was Dr. Robin Gibb, an assistant professor in the Department of Neuroscience at the University of Lethbridge. She conducts her research at the Canadian Center for Behavioral Neuroscience. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Research Council, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Ingenuity, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, the Alberta Conservation Association, Science Alberta Foundation, Ducks Unlimited Canada, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, and the NSERC ACR Integrated Landscape Management Research Chair. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.